Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my 2-week basic courtroom strategy and procedures class, and this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. And rule number one is don't say anything. Keep your mouth shut and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that is going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Now, government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. Now, listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet, shutting up, in the face of police interrogation, and indeed, in some cases, police intimidation. The first judge in U.S. v. Dickerson said, quote, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" The second judge in Belknap v. U.S. said, "You can and must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." And the third judge put it this way in Marchetti v. United States. He said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and the farsighted." Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, be sure to call the law school at 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package at the same time. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law school, and it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedures available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we've been looking at Larry Becraft's destroyed arguments on his website. I'm going to digress in this program and take you into a case called Vera Stretz, spelled S-T-R-E-T-Z, because most people, when they hear that you get into trouble, and it could be your Uncle Louie, or it could be your mom and dad, or a brother or a sister, you know, the advice that you get from lay people is, just tell the police your side of the story. Just tell the police what happened and you can go home. In fact, that's what the police always tell you. They arrest you, haul you off for interrogation, talk to you for a few hours, and they get all the information that they need out of you, all the information that they need to prosecute and convict you, whether you're guilty or innocent. Now, your lawyer will tell you, that's after, of course, somebody has told you what you need as a good lawyer. Now, this is pretty standard advice. If there's an auto accident, or if there's somebody injured, you yell out, "Is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house?" You don't say, "Is there a good doctor in the house? We don't want any bad doctors over here. Please, will a good doctor step forward?" We presume that doctors are all good. They're not, of course, but we presume they are. But lawyers, we don't presume, are good. We know that there's a bunch of shysters and bad lawyers out there. And so the advice that we receive from our friends and relatives is, "Oh my God, Bob, what you need is a good lawyer." So he's telling you out there, there's some bad lawyers, and watch out for those. I always like to ask students in class, can you tell me the difference between a good lawyer and a bad one? How do you select a good lawyer? How do you pick one out of the crowd? Does he wear long flowing robes and a turban? Does he appear in the yellow pages under the heading good lawyers, bad lawyers, mediocre lawyers? You know, the concept of selecting a good lawyer of and by itself is worth a broadcast or two. But once somebody has told you that what you need is a good lawyer, and they tell you that you just need to talk to the police and get your side of the story out and they'll understand, your attorney, when you hire him, will tell you that you should not take the witness stand in your own defense. And indeed, that's good advice for all guilty defendants, because in The Art of Cross-Examination, it's a book written by a guy named Francis Wellman, there are 23 techniques that we use in cross-examination to uncover the truth from a lying witness. And I always tell my students, the best thing that can happen to you is that your opponents lie about you. I would rather that the police get on the witness stand and lie than to get on the stand and tell the truth. Because if the police or if the adverse witnesses ever tell the truth about me, I'm dead in the water. Dead. D-E-D. But if the police or my adverse witnesses come in and they lie about me, I can uncover and reveal those lies to the judge or the jury. I can show that those people are lying, that their testimony is inconsistent. And if I can do that, and I'm a crummy plumber, can you imagine what a good skilled lawyer would do with a witness on the witness stand? And so the general rule that all lawyers learn in law school is never put your client on the witness stand, because 85% of all criminal defendants are guilty. 85%. 15% are innocent, and the jury will find 6% innocent. Of course, they find 6% of the guilty ones innocent too, so you never know who they're going to find innocent or guilty. But of the 15% statistically that are innocent, those are the 15% that we're concerned about, and we're presuming that you're innocent. My experience here over the years has jaded me. I've had so many students come in here and tell me they're innocent, and then after we go to trial, we find out the other side on examination or cross-examination will find out that they're lying, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes. And these people, I tell them plainly coming in, I say, now, if you've been lying to the police, if you're guilty, you want to tell me so that we can formulate our defense based upon the facts of the case, not upon some wishful thinking. But people don't want to admit to me that they're guilty, so they lie to me. Then they get on the witness stand and they lie, and the prosecuting attorney eats their lunch. So it's good advice for a guilty defendant not to take the witness stand, but if you're innocent, if you fail to take the witness stand, it's the kiss of death. Kiss of death. Write that down in your notes. This is Cross-Examination 101, and you should always take the witness stand in your own defense if, in fact, you're innocent. Because oftentimes the jury say, I'm like this, and oftentimes the jury, when you don't take the witness stand, your opponents have been over there pointing their fingers at you at the defense table saying, that's the man that raped me, that's the man that's guilty, that's the man that did it, and so on. And then you fold your arms and you don't say, no, I didn't do it. No, they're lying about me. That's not true, and subject yourself to cross-examination so that you can prove your innocence. Because your lawyer is going to tell you, see, you don't have to prove you're innocent. The government has to prove you're guilty. They don't have a problem doing that. They come in and they make all these allegations and bring in witnesses that point their finger at you and you don't deny it. That clinches the case. So that's a fallacy. Don't take the stand in your own defense. Hire a good lawyer and just tell the police your side of the story. And I'm going to tell you something here about telling the police your side of the story. There was a little girl out in Colorado, I think around Boulder, Colorado, and her name was Ramsey, little girl, about 6 years old. She was killed, 10 years ago or something like that. And they found the little girl down in the basement of the house. Now, the Ramseys, that's Mr. and Mrs. Ramsey, shut up. They wouldn't talk to the police. They wouldn't answer their questions or do jack squat. To this day, the Ramseys have never been prosecuted, but when a child dies, if the police cannot find an obvious assailant, they will always look to the parents as the killers, and almost always they convict the parents. Almost always. And that's because the parents are really innocent, and the parents not understanding cross-examination, not understanding that 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. It's a lie. Let me repeat that in case you're all sitting around the radio just stunned and stupefied. As I said, 25% of everything that comes out of your mouth is false. Did you know that? So when you go into the police department and you're trying to tell the police the truth, you're just trying to tell them everything that you know. And you're just spilling your guts. Well, 25% of what you're telling them is false. And when they talk to other witnesses, they take sworn statements from you, you say. They'll have a reporter there taking all this down. And they'll take every false statement that you made, and then they'll come back and they'll say, why are you making these false statements? And then you try to excuse these false statements, and then you lie some more. When in fact you're trying to tell the truth, but it's impossible because 25% of what everybody says is false. Now, you may actually believe what you're saying is true, but the bottom line is it's not. And that was first discovered by a fellow by the name of Edgar James Swift. He was a professor of psychology at Washington University in his volume called Psychology and the Day's Work. It was first published in 1918. Some 10 years subsequent to the suggestions on the subject, so far as it relates to the testimony of witnesses offered by me in a previous edition. Well, he devoted many pages to a most interesting and instructive discussion on the subject. It's a book with which every earnest student of cross-examination should be familiar. And Professor Swift relates that some very interesting experiments that he did in human observation that he's carried out with his psychology classes, from which he draws this conclusion. He said, quote, my experience have proved to me that in general, when the average man reports events or conversations from memory and conscientiously believes that he's telling the truth, about one-fourth of his statements are incorrect, and this tendency to false memory is the greater the longer the time since the original experience, unquote. So the police know that. And the police know that if they can get you to come in there and talk to them, that they can turn you upside down, turn you inside out, identify every false statement that you make, and then come back and use that against you in court to show the jury that you lied about the statements that you made concerning this crime. Therefore, you must be guilty. Now, that's the way the game is played, and that's why it's so important that when a potential legal issue comes up, you follow these three rules. Now listen carefully. Rule number one is keep quiet. Rule number two, don't say anything. Rule number three is shut up. Three rules of pro se litigation. Keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. Now, the lady by the name of Vera Stretz actually did that. It's very, very rare. And I'm going to read you a little story that comes out of a book called The Great American Trials, written by Edward W. Knappman, K-N-A-P-P-M-A-N. It's a very entertaining book. It's not the kind of book that a lawyer buys because he wants to learn something about law. This is a book that we lawyers buy, or law instructors, or police, or law enforcement people. We buy books like this because we want to be entertained. And so I pulled out a number of stories in here that I wanted to use to illustrate. One of them is Reynolds versus U.S., the famous polygamy case. And the other one here is Vera Stretz, S-T-R-E-T-Z. Now, Vera Stretz killed her boyfriend, and there was no way that she could deny that she killed her boyfriend. So she called the police, And when the police arrived, she handed them the gun and she said, "There's the body. I killed him." And at that point, she shut up and never said another word until trial. And she took the stand in her own defense, and she got on the witness stand, and she told the jury her story, which gave the prosecuting attorney approximately 5 minutes to prepare his cross-examination. Not 5 weeks or 5 months, where he could take her transcript testimony and use it as a deposition against her. He had just 5 minutes. Her testimony didn't take more than 5 minutes, and she was very straightforward and to the point. She alleged that it was self-defense. She never told anybody what her defense was or jack squat. And as a result, the jury came back and said, "Yeah, sounds pretty reasonable to us. We find her not guilty." I think it took them 30 minutes. Figured out. Listen to the story. Now, Vera Stratz was 29 years old when she spent some of her $35,000 inheritance from her mother on a cruise aboard the Volcania in December of 1934. It was there that she met Dr. Fritz Gebhardt, a German financier who was 42. Chatting in German, because her German was better than his English, they became casual friends. Soon after returning to New York City, Stratz and the doctor dated. Witty and gallant, Dr. Gebhardt seemed determined to sweep Vera Stratz off of her feet, but he had a wife and 2 children in Germany. The marriage, he said, had been one in name only for 10 years. "He told me that he loved me," Stratz later said. "And then he said that he was an unusual person. Ordinary laws applied to ordinary people, but for an unusual person there must be different standards. I was fascinated by him." Stratz found herself so deeply in love that in May she traveled with him to Lake George as Mrs. Gebhardt. Soon, Vera Stratz moved to Gebhardt's building, Beekman Towers, taking an apartment two floors below his. And as he traveled often, they exchanged passionate love letters. By November, Vera Stratz regularly responded to late-night calls from Gebhardt applying a heating pad to help him through stomach cramps as often as once a week. Early in November, when he returned from a European trip, he said that, "I'm going away again in December and you're going with me." Stratz assumed that he had decided to end his marriage, "and I'd better hurry with the wedding invitation," she said. "No," Gebhardt responded. He knew now that he was not the type to get married, and they would go on as before. So, Stratz told him that she would not compromise, that she wanted a home and a husband. "No one has ever left me before," he announced, "and you're not going to leave me now." Now, late in the night of November the 11th, in great stomach pain, Gebhardt called Vera Stratz. She put on a coat over her nightgown, slipped into shoes, and went up the back stairs to his apartment. At 2:30 a.m., shots were heard in Beekman Towers. The police were called. They discovered Vera Stratz sitting on the stairway just below the third floor. In her large handbag, they found a .32 caliber revolver, a box of bullets, 2 spent shells, and a crumpled silk nightgown with fresh, wet blood stains. "Did you shoot the man upstairs?" the police asked. "Yes, I did," sobbed Vera Stratz. "But please don't ask me why I did it." She said she was on the way to turn herself in. Now, the police grilled her for hours, but she would say nothing more, not a word. Her father, Frank Stratz, sent for Samuel Leibowitz, who had defended the Scottsboro boys and was known as the best criminal lawyer in the country. The newspaper called Stratz the icy blonde because she would not talk. They dug up Gebhardt's background. He had flown in World War I's famed Richthofen squadron, was a pal of pilot Hermann Göring, held doctorates in both philosophy and political economy, and had made $500,000 in international business deals, but had made the mistake, from Nazi Germany's point of view, of marrying a non-Aryan. He had, however, moved out, leaving her with two children and no divorce. Now, when the trial began on March 20, 1936, defense attorney Leibowitz probed each juror's knowledge of Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, the German philosopher whose idea of a super race attracted Adolf Hitler, and who said, "Man shall be trained for war, and women for the recreation of the warrior. All else is folly." Then, with Vera Stretz on the stand for 13 hours, Leibowitz carefully produced testimony on Gebhardt's attitude toward marriage and toward her. And when she announced the night of November 11th that she would not continue their relationship, she testified Gebhardt had thrown her on the bed and raped her. Next, while laughing at her and saying, quote, "If you want to make it the last night, you will have to make it a good one." And he demanded that she perform an act of sodomy so foreign to her and so shameful that she had been unable to tell the police. But now she recounted it. At the insistence of Judge Cornelius Collins, only through violent, uncontrollable sobbing, recalling seeing a gun in Gebhardt's chest of drawers, when she looked for his heating pad, she seized it. The doctor crying, "You damned whore, I will kill you," and he grabbed at the gun, she said. But the gun went off, and it fell on the bed, got up, lunged again at her, and she shot him again. Prosecutor Miles O'Brien cross-examined her for 4 hours. She killed, he insisted, in a hot fever of jealousy because Gebhardt wouldn't give up his wife for her. She is a tigress when provoked. But he was unable to produce a single contradiction in Stretz's testimony. I want to underline that for you, boys and girls. He was unable to produce a single contradiction in Stretz's testimony. And then it tells us she was telling the truth. Or, she had her story very simple. You know the old adage that says, keep it simple, stupid? And she stuck to her story. So he didn't know what her defense was going to be until she put her defense on and she took the witness stand, and since the good doctor was dead, she was the only witness who could testify as to what happened that night. Clear-cut case of self-defense. Now, had she gone into the police early on and just told her side of the story, the police would have cross-examined and they would have asked probing questions and she would have answered those questions, and 25% of what she said would have been false. Then they would have seized on all of her false statements and brought those false statements before the jury. In this case, there wasn't a single false statement to bring to the jury. The prosecutor didn't know what her testimony was going to be until she testified. So the adage that says, keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up, paid off. Now, you don't see very many cases where that comes up, but every case that you see where the defendant keeps his mouth shut and keeps the evidence away from the police, he always fares better and most often wins. Just like Vera Stretz. Well, the judge's charge lasted for 5 hours, defining first-degree murder, second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, and reasonable doubt. Excusable homicide and justifiable homicide. If you believe her story, he finished acidly, acquit her. Within 3 hours, the jury did so. Well, it wasn't 30 minutes, it was 3 hours. The furious judge went to his chambers without thanking the jury for its services. The next day, Stretz met the press. "Don't let this ruin your life," said a woman reporter. "My life is ruined already," said Vera Stretz. Years later, the defendant in his trial was identified only as one Laura Parr. When and how her name was changed from Vera Stretz remains a secret buried with her ruined life. There's the story of Vera Stretz. A couple of lessons to be learned here. The arguments that are destroyed are these. Don't tell the police, or just tell the police your side of the story, what happened, and you can go home. That argument is as phony as a $3 bill. When you talk to the police, not only aren't you going home, you probably are going to be convicted, whether you're guilty or innocent. Don't take the stand in your own defense is the general advice. That's another false story. If you don't take the stand in your own defense, the jury will look at you and say, well, what they're saying about the defendant must be true, otherwise he would have denied it. I often use this as an example. Here in the classroom, I will say to a student, I'll just look him right in the eyeball in front of everybody and say, you know, you look like a queer to me. And when you say that to someone, it's shocking. And they just look at you with a blank stare, and they don't answer a word. After I make my statement, you look like a queer to me, I shut up. Now, this is called the closing question. In sales, we ask the closing question. And the closing question is this. It says, do you want to pay by cash or check? And the first guy to speak loses. It's an old rule. It's been around for as long as I can remember, probably for hundreds of years, but at least for decades. I learned it back in the 1950s when I was selling newspapers. When you're selling newspapers, you ask the customer if he wants the Times or the Standard. Do you want the morning paper or the afternoon paper? You presume the customer is going to buy. When you make your presentation, I don't care whether the guy buys the morning or evening paper. I just want him to buy a subscription. And about 90% of the time, the guy will say, well, I'll pay by check. Well, as soon as he says he'll pay by check, well, then he's bought, hasn't he? You want the red carpet or the green carpet? You want to pay by cash or check? The judge asks the closing question this way. He says, do you want to plead guilty or not guilty? He didn't care. If you plead guilty, he's got you. If you plead not guilty, he's got you. Because once you plead not guilty, from that point on, you cannot win. Well, 94% of the time, you're going to lose. 6% of the time, you're going to win. 94% of the time, you're going to lose when you plead not guilty with a good lawyer in a conventional criminal defense posture. I mean, those are the statistics. Now, if you want to reverse those statistics, if you want to reverse those numbers, you start off by shutting up. You know when the policeman comes up to the window and he says, do you know how fast you were going? Yes, officer, I was going 75 miles an hour. Then out of your own mouth, you've condemned yourself. He didn't know how fast you were going, so he asked you the closing question. Do you know how fast you were going? If you answer, no, I don't, the policeman then says, well, would you be surprised if you were going 75 miles an hour? Yes, I would be surprised. I was only going 65. Okay, the speed limit was 55. So instead of speeding 20 miles an hour over the speed limit, you've admitted that you were only speeding by 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. So he's a nice cop. He just gives you a ticket for going 65. That's what you confessed to. In almost all criminal proceedings, the defendant has confessed to the crime, or if not an actual confession, he has given enough evidence to the police to convict him by his own statements out of his own mouth. The exception to that, of course, is this case of Vera Stretz. Now, I can cite to you 10 or 15 more cases where the defendant has kept his mouth shut and then went ahead and won the case. It's rare. Almost everybody has been taught from childhood to spill their guts, just tell the truth. And people do. They just tell what they believe is the truth, although 25% of it is false. That's the way that game is played. All right, hang on now. I've got to give you your midpoint program reminder that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives and can be accessed through the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, economics, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, to order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Remember, the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. The endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications so endorsed or recommended will reciprocate. Most of the authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, we're at the halfway point. Let me review another case here with you. It's called Reynolds versus United States, decided back about 1879, pretty old case. It's the famous case that deals with polygamy. Let me flip over here to page 183, where we find this case called Reynolds versus United States. The Mormons who settled Utah permitted members of their religion to practice polygamy. In Reynolds, the Supreme Court held that federal legislation banning polygamy was constitutional and did not violate the Mormons' First Amendment right to free exercise of their religion. The Reynolds case still remains the leading Supreme Court decision that the First Amendment does not protect polygamy. So I thought I would start the Reynolds story by showing you that this is a religious ideology. It doesn't have anything to do with the Bible. And that's because the Bible teaches the practice of polygamy. Yeah, the Bible and God, that is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I can't speak for all these other gods out here and all these other religions. But the Bible teaches that polygamy is a social status. It's a thing called marriage, and it's a part and parcel with marriage. And as early as Genesis 4, verse 19, a fellow by the name of Lamech, L-A-M-E-C-H, had two wives. In Genesis 28, verses 6 through 9, Esau had three wives. In the book of Judges, chapter 8, verse 30, Gideon had 20 wives. In 1 Samuel 1, verse 2, Samuel, the last judge in Israel, was the child of a plural marriage. He was the child of a polygamous marriage. His father had two wives. Now, King David, in 1 Kings 11, verse 3, in 1 Samuel, excuse me, it's King David is in 1 Samuel 25, verse 43, and in 1 Chronicles 14, verse 3. David, King David, had six wives. God himself said to David, let me quote this for you. If you think God is opposed to polygamy, now I'm not here pushing polygamy. I don't want you to get the wrong impression. I'm not here to sell it. I'm here to tell you that this Reynolds case is religious, and then we're dealing with a religious case here. I want to turn to 1 Samuel 25:43. 1 Samuel 25:43. And this guy, David, here, see what he's got here. Verse 43. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and they were also both of them his wives. Both of them his wives. He had another wife by the name of Abigail. David takes Abigail to wife and two others. That's three wives right there. Well, the other three wives came from God. So in 1 Chronicles 14, verse 3, let me see if that's the one I'm looking for. I'm pretty sure it is. 1 Chronicles 14, verse 3, God told David, David took more wives at Jerusalem, and David begat more sons and more daughters, for a total of six. Now, this guy is called a man after God's own heart. Never did God ever say one time, at least not in the Hebrew Scriptures, that he was opposed to polygamy. But we're going to see here when Reynolds has two wives, practicing this back in the 1870s, that the United States government got real excited about that. I mean, they really got bummed out. And they said, wait a minute, you can't have these two wives. Let me check here at 1 Kings 11, verse 3. I think there's another little piece to the story here. 1 Kings 11, verse 3, that I wanted to share with you. I think it's right out of God's own mouth here, if I got this right here. 11, verse 3. Let me see if I can find it here. Here we go. Now, that was King Solomon. King Solomon, in chapter 11, verse 3, he said, he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. And that's the quotation that preachers use and say, see, that's why polygamy is so bad. All those wives, they turned away his heart. Okay. So, some guys drink, some guys chase wild women. And some guys smoke dope. And it probably is bad for the guy that's done it. But that doesn't mean that it's against the law. There was nothing illegal or unlawful about Solomon having 700 wives. There's a clear report. The guy had 700 wives. And God said to David, he said, I gave you Saul's wife. And he did that when he got into this tiff, you know, over Bathsheba. He went out and killed a guy and stole his wife, you know, and that was a bad scene, and God tuned him up for that. Now, this guy Reynolds now, he's practicing this polygamy, which every Christian knows is just totally unscriptural. And I want you to go, you Christians, now to the Scriptures and show me where polygamy is unscriptural. Could you do that? Show me where having two wives is bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil, and is going to send you straight to hell and burn forever. Can you? There are 24 cases of polygamy in the Bible. 24 cases of polygamy, not one negative comment. None. Especially by God. Now, he gets kind of negative about sodomy. He gets kind of negative, you know, about unjust weights and balances and about witchcraft and a whole host and plethora of other subjects in there, not a negative word about polygamy. All right, now in the Reynolds case, after a somewhat checkered history and a long trek westward in the mid-19th century, the followers of a religious prophet named Joseph Smith settled the western lands that became the state of Utah. Their religion was called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Most people called them the Mormons. They held a variety of novel beliefs, ranging from their conviction that Jesus Christ visited the American Indians to a prohibition against caffeine drinks such as coffee and tea. Their most controversial belief, however, was that a man could have more than one wife. I can't find anything in the Bible that would indicate to me that you can't drink coffee or tea. I can find a lot in the Bible that would indicate to me that you can have two wives. Now, for some reason, we don't care about people who don't drink coffee or tea, or who believe that Jesus came to the New World and talked to the Indians, or have any other wild, crazy ideas. But, oh my God, the idea that this guy would have two wives, it just goes to the core of Christian theology. We just can't tolerate that. Okay. Even though we live in a land of religious tolerance, I often wondered, what difference does it make to George Gordon whether Joe Sixpack over there has 2 6 or 9 wives? I don't really care. Now, we Americans have said we don't care what goes on in somebody's bedroom between two consenting adults. They can practice sodomy or bestiality or any other kind of filth and perversion, which is actually condemned in the Scripture. But, oh my God, if this guy actually goes out and marries 2 women, 5 women, or 10 women, like Gideon had 20 wives, well, we can't tolerate that. Which just goes to show you that Christians don't follow the Scripture. What they follow is theology. They follow religion. That's my point. Now, this guy Reynolds is a religious guy. He's a Mormon. I'm not a Mormon, and I'm not here to tout Mormonism. I'm here to tell you that this guy is a religious guy, and he wants to practice a religious practice. Homosexuals want to practice their sexual practices. Americans are all for it. 63%, all for. Go ahead, go do it. It's okay by us. Well, then what's wrong with those Mormons having two wives? What is so wicked and evil about that? These same 63% of Americans would just come unhinged and go ballistic on you and say, oh my God, that's unchristian. That's unreligious. That's really bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil. So my challenge again, show me that in the Scripture and send me an email, would you? Now remember, most of the United States knew about the Mormon practice of polygamy since 1852. Most Americans were traditional Christians, and they believed in monogamy, or having only one spouse. Now, until the Mormons arrived, however, there were no federal laws against bigamy, the legal term for marrying a second spouse while still married to a first spouse, or polygamy, the practice of having several spouses at the same time. The government left the Mormons alone for many years, but in 1862, President Abraham Lincoln signed the Morrell Anti-Bigamy Act into law. The Morrell Act outlawed polygamy throughout the United States in general, and in Utah in particular. The government did not do much to enforce the law because it was preoccupied with the Civil War. But after the Civil War, Congress regained interest in the question of Mormon polygamy. Congress strengthened the Morrell Act by passing the Poland Law in 1874. Now, the Poland Law increased the powers of the federal judiciary within the territory of Utah because federal judges were federally appointed. They were more likely to be non-Mormons and thus more aggressive about enforcing the law. Mormon leader Brigham Young and George Q. Cannon, territorial delegate to Congress and advisor to Young, decided to challenge the federal government in court. They were very confident that if the government tried any Mormons for bigamy, the United States Supreme Court would throw out their convictions, based on the First Amendment right to free exercise of their religion. Therefore, they planned to arrange for a test case to be brought to court. Young and Cannon chose Young's personal secretary, a devout Mormon and practicing polygamist, George Reynolds. So Reynolds was the goat in this test case. Young and Cannon were successful. The government indicted Reynolds for bigamy in October of 1874. Reynolds had to be retried, however, due to jury selection problems. The government indicted Reynolds again in October of 1875. The judge was Territorial Supreme Court Chief Justice Alexander White, and the prosecutor was William Carey. George W. Biddle and Ben Sheeks represented Reynolds. Now, the government charged that Reynolds was currently married to both Mary Ann Tuddenham and Amelia Jane Schofield, and the prosecution had very little difficulty in providing or proving that Reynolds lived with both women, despite some trouble in serving Schofield with her subpoena. The following dialogue is an excerpt from the prosecution's questioning of Arthur Pratt, a deputy marshal sent to serve a subpoena on Schofield. Question. State to the court what efforts you have made to serve the subpoena. Answer. I went to the residence of Mr. Reynolds, and a lady was there, his first wife, and she told me that this woman was not there, and that was the only home that she had, but that she hadn't been there for 2 or 3 weeks. I went again this morning, and she was not there. Question. Do you know anything about her home where she resides? Answer. I know where I found her before. Question. Where? At the same place. Now, following more evidence of Reynolds' 2 marriages, which the defense had no chance of refuting, Judge White gave instructions to the jury. White's instructions smashed Reynolds' defense that by virtue of the First Amendment, he was innocent because of his Mormon religious beliefs. Now, if you find that Reynolds deliberately married a second time, having a first wife living, the want of consciousness of evil intent, the want of understanding on his part that he was committing crime, did not excuse him, but the law inexorably in such cases implies criminal intent. The jury found Reynolds guilty on December the 10th, 1875. On July 6th, 1876, the Territorial Supreme Court affirmed his sentence. Reynolds appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court on November 14th of 1878. Biddle and Sheeks argued to the Supreme Court that it must overturn Reynolds' conviction on the basis of the First Amendment. Well, on January the 6th, 1879, the Supreme Court of the United States upheld the trial court's decision. The Supreme Court said that the First Amendment did not protect polygamy and based its decision on historic American cultural values. Underline that, boys and girls. Their decision was based upon historic American cultural values. It wasn't predicated upon the Bible, the law of Moses, the law of God, or the religious free exercise clause of the First Amendment. The court said, we're basing our decision on historic American cultural values. The majority opinion held, quote, polygamy has always been odious among the northern and western nations of Europe, and until the establishment of the Mormon Church was almost exclusively a figure of the life of Asiatic and African people. At common law, the second marriage was always void, and from the earliest history of England, polygamy has been treated as an offense against society. In the face of all of this evidence, it is impossible to believe that the constitutional guarantee of religious freedom was intended to prohibit legislation in respect to this most important feature of social life. Marriage, while from its very nature a sacred obligation, is nevertheless, in most civilized nations, a civil contract and usually regulated by law. Underline the words, it is a civil contract. Why is the government involved in marriage? How did that come about? If the government isn't involved in baptism, why is the government involved in marriage? And that's because marriage and the family are the building blocks of society. For government to control society, it must control marriage. So it's a control mechanism, and that's why we have marriage licenses. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't have marriage licenses, and there's no law under our Constitution that requires that you get a marriage license. I have a wife, and I'm not married with a marriage license. People say to me, well, you don't have a real marriage. Yeah, I guess you're right. I just have a pretend marriage. Okay? So we just pretend. But I don't have a marriage license. Call it what you will. What happened in the Reynolds case was Reynolds never testified that he didn't have a marriage license. Now understand something fundamental here. You don't have a right to go out and marry at the civil law with a civil ceremony with a marriage license to women. It's prohibited. Notice they said it's a contract. It's a civil contract. And it's regulated by law. Now, if you would stay out of those civil contracts, which, by the way, are strictly prohibited in Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Let me flip over here. Let me show you what God told you about making contracts with these foreign and alien gods, the United States of America being one of them. He said in verse 32, "You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you to sin against me. Because if you serve their gods, it'll surely be a snare unto you." You get that? Now, three times in the scripture, in Exodus 32, verse 34, Exodus 33, verse 2, in Judges 2, 1 through 3, in addition to this citation right here, we're told not to make contracts, covenants, treaties, agreements with these foreign and alien gods. It's an act of idolatry. Reynolds never testified that he did not have a marriage license. The presumption, then, is that he must have had a marriage license. He had two wives. We presume that everybody is married with a marriage license, don't we? Well, think about it this way. When you introduce your wife or you introduce your husband to somebody, have you ever had someone say, "I think you're lying to me. Produce your marriage license and prove to me that you're married. I think you people are just pretending. You're just lying." You ever had that happen? I've never seen that occur. I've introduced my wife many times, and everybody takes her at face value. And the presumption is that we must have a marriage license. This is called a fiction of law. Since most people have a marriage license, you must have one. Reynolds failed to plead out of the fiction of law. Here's the rest of the story. Therefore, the Supreme Court upheld Reynolds' sentence of 2 years imprisonment and a $500 fine. The Supreme Court's decision rocked the Mormons, who initially vowed to defy the court, but later seemed to accept the inevitable. In 1890, Mormon leader Wilford Woodruff issued a document called the Manifesto, which terminated any marriages forbidden by the law of the land. After 1890, most Mormons abandoned polygamy. Now, the Mormons didn't have a very truly and sincerely held religious belief. I don't remember that Jesus, Peter, Paul, or John, or any of the apostles gave up their religious beliefs and practices because the Roman Empire was persecuting them. I don't remember that. I can remember many examples in the New Testament where the apostles complained, reported that they were persecuted, jailed, beaten, stoned for their religious beliefs and practices, which they would not give up. The Mormons didn't have any such truly and sincerely held religious beliefs and practices. They gave them up, did they not? Not that polygamy is commanded by God. It is not. You do not have to practice polygamy. No law requires it. But there's no law in the Bible that prohibits it either. And it's a social event that even God himself was a participant in. In Isaiah 50 verse 1, Jeremiah 3 verse 8, and Jeremiah 3 verse 14, those three scriptures tell you in Isaiah 50 verse 1 that he gave a bill of divorcement to Israel, that he was married to Judah and Israel, and that he was a polygamist, married to these two nations, Israel and Judah. Take it, look it, check it for yourself. Isaiah 50 verse 1, Jeremiah 3 verse 8, Jeremiah 3 verse 14. Now, I'm not here to promote or to tell you that you ought to practice polygamy. I don't practice it. I don't think it's for me. But I'm not throwing rocks at those that practice polygamy. Now, the people who do practice polygamy today do so without a marriage license. I have never seen a single one of them prosecuted. I've been in this business 21 years. 21 years. Haven't seen a case of it. I've looked through the literature. I don't find any cases anywhere. Now, listen. You can go out here and have sexual relations with 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 other women. Nobody gives a rat's rectum one way or the other. You can be as licentious as Bill Clinton. Nobody ever accused him of being a polygamist. Can you imagine the outcry against Bill Clinton if he would have married a second woman? Nobody cares how many women he's having sex with. We're just concerned about this guy marrying two women. Now, when you marry, you marry without a marriage license. You don't need a marriage license to marry. I don't remember any place in the Bible where anybody ever got a license from anybody to go out and marry. Marriage used to be a religious thing that when you wanted to marry, you went to this girl's father. This is when we practice patriarchal family and property rights. Today, we practice communism, the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. But I want to remind you, boys and girls, there was a time in America when we practiced Republican form of government and property rights. So the female belongs to the father. That's why the groom came to the father, the prospective groom, and he said, "May I marry your daughter?" And he paid a bride price. That's why we have dowries and bride prices. Because it's a property. You have to buy this girl from the owner. That's the father. Now, the marriage is conducted by the priest, who isn't licensed by the state. This is a religious ceremony, which is recorded in the family Bible in a patriarchal family. We don't have that anymore. We don't have patriarchal. We don't have matriarchal families. These matriarchal families are recorded at the county recorder's office after you get permission from the owner of the bride, which is the state, because she has a marriage license, which is the, she has a birth certificate, which is the prima facie evidence that she's the chattel property of the state. So we have simply changed our law from the old biblical law, the old common law, to the Roman civil law, and we practice that under the forms of communism today. Reynolds over here failed to plead out of the fiction of law. Had he come into court and said, "Hey, listen, I got two women over here having sex with them all the time." The government star witness against him came in and testified against him. He was a polygamist, and the prosecutor asked him, "What do you call it?" And he said, "Fornication." Fornication. All right, we'll take a look at this next time. We're about out of time, but keep in mind that there are two elements to a crime: an act with intent. Reynolds committed the act. What was his intent? Well, his intent was to challenge the law. The Mormons wanted to have civil marriages. They have them to this day. You get a marriage license to get married for all time and eternity in the temple. What are you doing that for, Mormons? Why are you bringing the state, the government, the secular government, into your religion? Talk about separation of church and state. You don't have it in Mormon marriages. All right, we're out of time. I got to give you your final reminder here, boys and girls, and that is that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and we're open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, economics, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. And The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So thanks for listening, and until then, good night, friends.